Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight's lecture is presented by the Boston University College of Fine Arts as part of its Contemporary Perspectives lecture series. Speaking will be Carol Becker, Dean of Columbia University School of the Arts. Introducing Dean Becker is Lynn Allen, Director of Boston University's School of Visual Arts.
It's my pleasure to welcome Carol Becker, who in my book is tops. She is not only a true leader as Dean of the Columbia School of the Arts in New York City, but was also the Dean of Faculty and Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. She received her PhD in Literature at the University of San Diego, has been a lecturer in women's studies since the late 1960s, and has written numerous books. Her newest, Thinking in Place, will be in bookstores soon. She is also a cultural critic and an educator. As a writer, Carol has mulled over the obsolete attitudes and strategies of the art world for a long time, particularly the artist's responsibility to society. Her interests range from feminist theory to American cultural history, the education of artists, to politics here and abroad. She addresses many questions, among them, what does contemporary cultural production look like? And she is eager to talk and write about this and other topics pertinent to our time. Carol has said her writing hovers between theory, memoir, history, and other forms, and she strives to write clearly so all complexities can be understood. Please join me in welcoming Carol Becker to Boston University.
Hi, everybody. Thank you very much, Lynn. I'm going to read a piece to you that is in my new book, and or a version of it anyway. It takes a while to read. Hopefully it'll be interesting to you. And I think I'm just going to jump in. I'm going to start with a quote, and it's from Nestor Clancleny, who is one of my favorite writers, and he says, "What we call art is not only that which culminates in great works, but rather a space where society carries out its visual production." So what do the practitioners of art design and architecture, as well as art educators, art therapists, art and design historians, curators, and visual and critical studies scholars, those who comprise the faculty, students, and administrators of art school environments, all have in common? And I would suggest two things: visual sophistication, a way of seeing that is very developed, and a way of working that to others might not look like work at all. Such practitioners live in the world of ideas and in the manifestation of these ideas into visual form. And what this piece is going to attempt to do, it's going to attempt to strip down what it is that we actually do and what it is we actually believe in and what does that mean for future. One could argue that those engaged in advertising are also extremely savvy about the visual, using their skills to seduce potential customers. But while practitioners of art and design also attempt to seduce viewers through visual forms, there is often, although not always, a difference in intention between these forms of production and delivery. Implicit and explicit in the education of artists and designers is an emphasis on using one's visual skills to further consciousness, to make oneself and one's audience more astute, and to help one's environment become more functional and inspiring. Of course, many artists and designers do not function with these values in the foreground, but the educational process out of which they have emerged, if it was a true academic environment and not commercially focused, was probably founded on values more humane than simply wanting to lull people into spending more money. Fixating on false needs, feeding destructive impulses, or developing an obliviousness to the social reality. Those educating artists and designers, on the contrary, often hope to instill in their students a desire to create unique spaces within which the visual can help all of us recognize our deepest emotions, ask difficult questions, see reality stripped of illusion, and then gain the courage to confront this reality when necessary. Really good art and design should also allow us to understand that the imagination, when given space within which to expand, is able to experience its own nature as infinite. However, the desire for material or financial success may ultimately thwart these lofty goals. These values make up the foundation upon which most schools of art and design and architecture are built, and this is where the education of the practitioners of these disciplines often begin. Play and process. Fundamental to such creative environments is the belief in and commitment to process, how one gets from the beginning of an idea to its visual expression. Artists, designers, architects, and all who grapple with the development of ideas into form have a fundamental faith that if they give themselves over entirely to the process of creating, then an object, event, or an environment will emerge. How one creates and develops ideas is a very subtle, alchemical, impalpable endeavor, and like thinking itself, is difficult to describe. This solitary activity of allowing ideas to manifest as they choose needs to be nurtured and protected if one is to succeed in the arts. Almost nowhere else in the world of work is process and the state of mind that enables it so valued for itself as a useful activity that needs no other justification. Creative people assume that, like the practices of meditation or thinking, the concentrated open-endedness of following the process of thought will lead to knowledge. For artists, the process of thinking through the act of making is a form of reflection. And although process may at first seem like an inefficient, indulgent, or impractical methodology to foster, it is the only way to create the space-time module within which an unfettered imagination can experiment joyfully. Play is inextricably linked to process, but for most adults is perceived as abandonment of one's responsibilities, or at least a break from them. But for artists and designers, play is understood as serious work. Play is what the gods do. It is what mortals, at least grown mortals, rarely are allowed to engage. And yet it is fundamental to creation. Play is the ability to abandon a sense of utility, to get lost in the present, to allow the imagination to roam freely and to be taken along its path without stopping to ask the importance, meaning, or usefulness of the journey. In art making, it can necessitate the willingness to break rules, trample conventions, and simply allow the whimsy of an idea to float because it seems exciting and brings pleasure. In nature, play can appear as excess and can manifest as extravagance or the unexpected. Why, for example, are there so many kinds of birds, so many colors, so much diversity? Biologists have speculated that one could understand this abundance of form as a type of play. A sense of play governs artists' focus on process, but it also can animate the finished work. Works of art thrive when they communicate a sense of play, but it is not easy to play as a grown-up. Picasso understood this very well. People would often look at his drawings and comment, "Oh, my child could do that," to which the artist would respond, "Perhaps, but you can't." Children give themselves over to their imaginations with abandon, but most adults have lost this ability, having become too self-conscious to be truly spontaneous. Artists and designers who capture the collective imagination for a time are often those who are most playful. Part of the radicality of the design for Frank Gehry's Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao is its use of materials. Titanium creates a luminous and unexpected surface for the structure that is particularly seductive because it sparkles and reflects. Such shininess in the midst of the gray Basque city makes the building feel playful. The museum is breathtaking in its form and its placement at the end of a street of traditional buildings and on the water, which shimmers with intriguing images. It also is an excellent example of what is now possible as a result of computer design. When it was first built, it seemed as if it were the very first building of the 21st century, precisely because it was so astoundingly irreverent of the expectation of its historical location, and yet it works. Good architecture should empower and enliven us to imagine the future and make our work and lives more pleasurable, functional, safe, and aesthetically engaging. It should encourage us to take risks, change the culture of existing taste, but also engage us in serious types of play. Most buildings do not do any of this, or so when one does, it becomes a real source of attraction. Perhaps the inclusion of Jeff Koons's puppy at the museum's entrance should be read as a fundamental statement about the connection between this building and the notion of play. Why else have an enormous puppy made of geranium standing guard at the front door? In the mythology of art making, those outside the process often perpetuate a belief that artists only play, sensing the free-form nature of the creative process as quite a departure from most structural work. And artists themselves often feel conflicted and even guilty when they take pleasure in the freedom of what they do. But artists know that creative work of this kind is a serious endeavor and is often terrifying as they face self-doubt and possible critical repudiation. Artists, like others whose work requires the risk of public humiliation, live in this anxiety much of the time. When one is working with young artists and designers, part of the challenge is to help direct them through their own difficult moments in the creative process when, for whatever reasons, they get stuck fixating on a sense of inadequacy. Their ability to navigate the turmoil and uncertainty of the creative psyche could be the most important skill they learn from their professors. These educators try to communicate that all creative people experience such moments and that the ability to suspend judgment on oneself and one's work while following ideas as they evolve is the only way through these treacherous vortices. And even as teachers are reassuring their students, encouraging them to break through their internal resistances, they themselves often face similar fears of failure once alone in their studios. No one working creatively is exempt from such moments, but because they are in the creative process, professional artists and designers often can help those just starting out. Another way past creative fears and the barriers to creativity they present is artists' inherent passionate and fundamental need to keep working. For people in most societies, the motivation to work is imposed from the outside, through necessity, and then through the demands of a job. These structures to keep them locked into work, as conventions have determined, but artists most often generate their own jobs and projects, whether employed to do so or not, and therefore must be driven and propelled from the inside. Through the process of work, they are able to break through their own resistances. Artists' inner motivation is something that an educational environment needs to help students learn to cultivate and negotiate, since it is essential for the successful production of work. Often such motivation is connected to obsession, the almost unnatural focus that keeps someone returning again and again to the same area of study, the same acts of engagement, until the energy for the project dissipates or transforms with the constant repetition and final completion of a body of work. Faculty at the School of the Art Institute, where I was a professor and also dean for many years, often take groups of students, artists, designers, architects, and writers on study trips abroad. When I first led such a trip to Southeast Asia, we visited Angkor Wat in Cambodia. The site is comprised of miles and miles of ancient buildings and temples whose facades have been carved over centuries with the stories of Buddhist classics such as the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. Here, a printmaking student spent almost an entire week at one temple working on rubbings and drawings of a very small section of a corner of one wall's iconography. She had become obsessed and had narrowed the scope of the unmanageable scale of the compound into something she could effectively recreate in drawing. In January 2006, on our globalized city study trip to Bangkok, Hanoi, and Luang Prabang in Laos, another student became intensely interested in the color of gold in Bangkok. And in the 60 local Buddhist temples in Luang Prabang, he spent his entire time in Luang Prabang, the former spiritual capital, photographing gold ornamentation, gold leaf painting and adornment, and gold-sprayed stencils. For 10 days, he rose with the sun and the chanting of the monks and worked until the sun had set. Each student, artist, designer, art historian, visual and critical studies scholar, arts administrator, art educator, undergraduate, graduate, and graduate student had accumulated at least 1,000 images before we returned to the U.S., and some had made video and sound recordings as well. Such are the passions of artists and designers. Once something grabs them, it doesn't let them go. A high level of concentration and unrelenting obsession with detail, while trusting intuition and giving oneself over to the process of making, are some of the qualities that young artists and designers need to learn to navigate. These are also positive attributes that they can then offer the world. By contrast, most of contemporary society tends to move too quickly, give up too easily, become distracted, desperately seek the new, and tread either too harshly or too lightly on the old to really see the obvious and the extraordinary in the ordinary, and to locate themselves and their activities in the everyday present. The qualities creative people demonstrate may seem impractical in their non-utilitarian excess, but are the most practical and potentially liberating of all if one is to achieve a creative life, accomplish meaningful work, and help to encourage the evolution of a sane society, which can only come into being if it is imagined. Jean-Paul Sartre wrote, "He who begins with facts will never arrive at essences." Perhaps we can say that those who pursue a subject with passion, with the heart as well as the mind, and with the spirit of play always intact, will more likely come to grasp it at its core than those who rely on information, quantification, or objectification. To transform society, one has to throw oneself into the experience of it in all its dimensionality. Otherwise, its complexity will remain elusive. Schools of art and design not only work to create environments that allow for and encourage such focused effect, but they also try to teach students how to create such environments for themselves once they leave, set up their own studios, and discipline work schedules. Instructors, for example, rather than overemphasizing tangible results, the actual thing created, focus students' attention on the modes of experimentation, the conditions within which one is able to work, the questions asked, the methodologies employed, the state of mind achieved. This type of thought is often activated through critiques of student work that are intended to help move the work and the artist forward. Such environments also encourage a definition of success that signifies an effective manifestation of ideas into exciting forms, a definition not based on fashion or marketability, but on whether the piece works in terms of its own integrity and the artist's or designer's intent. In the larger society, value is generally not ascribed to one's progress on a creative path. The courage demonstrated on the journey, the level of knowledge gained along the way, or the innovations expressed. Rather, value is primarily attributed to the outcome, the product, about which the world asks questions such as these. Is it useful? What is its monetary value? Who will respond to it? It is therefore often difficult to explain to those outside creative circles how something that has not as yet accrued value in the global economy and that may never receive a notable reception, i.e. has not yet been deemed useful, could ever be understood as successful. It is also not easy to explain how embracing failure is actually essential to all unique achievements and should not be feared any more than the accident or the unexpected, all of which might turn everything around and open up possibilities not recognized or understood at the outset of a project. Students often come to schools of art and design having previously been in situations where they were deemed the most talented artist. At art school, they find themselves surrounded by others whom they quickly recognize are at least as gifted. This situation can create anxiety. Some young artists and designers respond by trying to impress their peers, by sticking to the type of work that previously brought them success. But in the art school environment, the pedagogical approach is to encourage the opposite. Unlearn all that came before, start now, and don't be afraid to fail. Communities of artists, designers, thinkers, and educators understand the value of trial and error, the need to fail, and that what at first appears to be an inconsequential element, an addendum of thought, might prove to be the most important discovery of the entire endeavor. In short, they recognize the value of a playful, boundaryless, free-form process. A designed object using robotics or electronics might not have achieved the imagined purpose, but it could take its inventor much closer to understanding how technologies might be effective, or the technique embodied in a useless sculpture may prove to be a practical design component for a future commercial application. The World Wide Web, as it was called, was originally conceived by high-tech types as a communication tool to be in touch with each other. No one initially imagined the extent of its potential. A painting that does not work visually, as artists say, could still be the most successful manifestation of an idea the artist has accomplished to date. Learning to make it work is part of the creative process and a large element of what needs to be learned before an artist or designer can become a mature practitioner. The U.S. market economy prides itself on risk and innovation, so one cannot say that it is risk-averse, but it is failure-averse. In the U.S., we tend to admire and romanticize the spirit of adventure only when it leads to measurable success. But those breaking ground in any field of human endeavor know that without recognition and acceptance of the value of failure, there can really be no true risk-taking. And without risk-taking, there can be no innovation. In addition, one cannot live honestly as a human being and as a citizen of society, open and with a courageous heart and mind, if one is not able to admit when one has failed, either when it has led to greater knowledge or when it has caused pain. At a societal level, the fear of failure is apparent in U.S. society. One need only look at the history of the U.S. response to Vietnam and the American War, as the Vietnamese call it, as an example. America lost that war, but this fact is never spoken in mainstream U.S. media. It is as if the admission of loss might create a stigma from which the country could never recover, or the collective ego would simply crumble under the weight of the historical truth. The result of this failure of recognition is that the society, not having recovered from Vietnam, has repeated its mistakes. For example, it became very difficult to speak the truth about why the U.S. began the war in Iraq. After the deaths of thousands of U.S. soldiers and hundreds of thousands of civilians, it is very difficult for the collective to accept the idea that all these people might have died in vain in a war whose origins were based on deception and manipulation. And so long as the truth is not spoken, the reality is still not confronted. The societal consciousness cannot truly feel the magnitude of what has occurred or move on to the next level of understanding. Accepting failure at a personal and societal level allows us to create different situations out of which we might better actualize our intent. These understandings emerge through process, through the space allowed for transformation and evolution, for the experimentation and criticality, while leading us to admit failure, which might take us just where we want to go. Temporalities, Part 1. Those who live in the world of art and design recognize that the most interesting ideas and work of a particular time often cannot be recognized as such in its time by lay people and even by the art world itself. This is an important point for young artists to understand. They need to learn to trust their own ability to evaluate the quality of their work and that of others in spite of the public's reception to the work. This is something we talked about this afternoon. People educated to look differently with great discernment may see value where those with a less cultivated visual sense cannot. Over time, a larger group also may come to recognize the merit of something as the general level of society's visual sophistication increases and the ideas behind the work, at one time considered radical or even simply bad, become safely absorbed into the collective consciousness. We have witnessed this phenomenon repeatedly throughout the history of art, design, and the making of culture. When studying art history, it is surprising to learn that Impressionism, the most mainstream, uplifting, sensual genre of painting, now broadly co-opted by advertising, was once considered so scandalous that pregnant women were advised not to look at these paintings lest they cause them to abort. Even Van Gogh, whose magnificent paintings are now reproduced all over the world, sold only one painting while he was alive, Red Vineyard at Arles, and we know that he died penniless and forlorn. To recount this story is not to romanticize the inevitability of the artist as poor and starving in body and spirit, but rather to emphasize that in the case of Van Gogh, the problem was never that the work was not interesting enough, but rather that the work was perhaps too interesting when it was made to be recognized as such. In another example, Louis Kahn, one of the great architects of the 20th century, died in debt and alone in Grand Central Station in New York. Yet people now understand what an excellent designer he was and travel from all over the world to see the Salk Institute in La Jolla, California, or the Kimball Art Museum in Fort Worth, Texas, buildings now deemed by many as perfect in both sighting and form. It would benefit artists and designers to take the time to reflect on the meaning of these stories in relationship to individual lives and to their own practice. These true stories tell us repeatedly that success, as it has been defined in the art and design worlds for at least the last two centuries, isn't always the true measure of what is actually well done and important in the development of ideas. Rather, it is often an indication of what people are able to accept and understand at the time. Work that has been substantially ahead of its time or ahead of the context within which it was presented, years, even decades later, may eventually be recognized for its innovation and even regarded as a classic. Originality and brilliance are historical and contextual constructs. The market value of artwork translated for the artist as fame and riches is often only attributed over time, long after the life of their creators has ended. Some works initially fail only because they are not positioned within a receptive context or for the right audience, or because they are presented in an inauspicious moment. Waiting for Godot was a flop when it opened for its first American production in Coconut Grove, Miami, in January 1956, starring Burt Lahr, who played the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz. It was mistakenly billed as a raucous comedy, which set up a false expectation with a mainstream audience. The Miami production closed quickly. Produced some months later in April 1956 for a more sophisticated New York audience who had already heard about the play's successes in Europe, it was a tremendous success. And when performance theorist Herb Blau, then teaching in San Quentin Prison, staged the play there in 1957, it was so well received by evidence of the 1,400 inmates that it helped spawn the first prison drama society. In 2007, contemporary artist Paul Chan restaged Waiting for Godot in New Orleans with Creative Times in various locations in the Lower Ninth Ward and in Gentilly, recontextualizing the play in relationship to the desperation people have felt since the aftermath of Katrina. Thousands of people came to witness these performances. Artists and those who curate them often have their hand on the pulse of the collective psyche. In recognizing changes occurring in society before others do, they have to maintain the confidence to trust their instincts and not to bow to what is considered acceptable. In a now famous incident, Marcia Tucker, founder of the New Museum, who died in 2006, curated a show of Richard Tuttle's work for the Whitney Museum in 1976, when she was employed as its curator of painting and sculpture. The show's reception was very negative. Most critics were simply unable to see the value of this quiet, small-scale work at all, perhaps because it was shown on the heels of abstract expressionism with its grandiosity of scale and aspiration. Tucker was asked to leave the Whitney, and the next day she went on to found the New Museum. Tuttle is now considered a major figure in contemporary art, and the New Museum has secured its place for the future, which opened this year and is very architecturally exciting in its new home in Lower Manhattan. Those who produce new works and those who choose to show them must be simultaneously very permeable, available, accessible to that which might pass through them, and yet tough enough to withstand the rejection expressed in word, deed, and limited compensation that might be short-term or might last a lifetime. They need to cultivate a true independence of mind so that they can weather the opinions of others who may have a less sophisticated or a less daring sensibility. Even those who have gained great prominence for breaking ground in their fields may actually resist the innovations of others and, surprisingly, stay wedded to the status quo and therefore, out of fear, jealousy, or insecurity, reject the new. All of these situations and the underlying tests of judgment and values they embody need to be communicated to the next generation of creative practitioners so that they truly understand that the reception of their innovations, if negative, should not be devastating, since these judgments will be dependent on the historical and sociological situation of the moment in which their work is being evaluated. They need to be able to distinguish this type of rejection from that which comes because the work is simply not complete or reconciled with itself. Nonetheless, it is both the new and the rethinking of the old that comprise the terrain they must explore, no matter the consequences. Temporalities, Part 2, Artists and Designers as Travelers. Artists have often lived cosmopolitan lives. Even without much money, they have found a way to travel, propelled by a longing to see the great works of multiple civilizations that they have read about in art history. Within the world of educating artists and designers, there has always been a great value placed upon viewing significant works in situ. One cannot adequately imagine painting and sculpture, buildings and monuments from reproductions, and contextualization is crucial to experience what Walter Benjamin has referred to as aura. Many artists and designers also have felt a kinship with other practitioners across cultures, finding in the work of other civilizations similar goals, methodologies, and often an even more innovative visual acuity. This has propelled them to spend time within other societies, but now the urgency to understand how art and artists, design and designers fit into multiple societies has become even more essential. If young artists and designers are to be useful to this historical time, they need to understand their own society and its complexities, but they also need to comprehend a much broader global concept of society, where they fit within it, what they might add to it, and then to learn how they can move fluidly within multiple realities. Young practitioners need to be prepared for the contemporary world they are entering, a world moving so quickly where at best East and West, North and South converge and merge, and where cultures intersect and learn from each other, and at worst, where cultures collide, endangering the existence of all species and the well-being of the planet itself. It is the complexity of cultural integrity, cultural hybridization, and cultural interaction that young artists and their professors must now consider. Complexity, or densification, needs to be a core value embedded in the educational process. It is no longer enough to know one society. Artists must understand multiple contexts. Most of us do not want the world to become flattened out or oversimplified, and there is a fear that globalization could come to mean homogenization. Many creative people find this idea terrifying and take inspiration from the places where the cultural terrain is thick and rich, which pulls them into societies other than their own. Young practitioners must embrace this complexity so that they are unafraid of the world's diversification and not immobilized by its social problems. While acknowledging the world's vastness, they still need to reproduce its specificities effectively. I have always believed that the capacity to navigate this type of cultural layering and not to be daunted by it is best achieved by travel. Young artists benefit from moving through different temporalities and forms of production. How else can any of us ever imagine the concept of the global citizen and make it concrete if we don't attempt to experience the world's complexity directly? Writing about postcolonialism in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, while helping us all to understand the relationship of dominance and submission that were inherent in colonial structures and thought, have also made some creative practitioners too self-conscious to interact with these societies, as if exploitation must be an unavoidable outcome. Educators need to open students' hearts as well as their minds to ensure that they are not immobilized by theory. Essential as a starting point to understand the historical dynamics of how colonialism and its aftermaths have functioned, theory should not be intimidating or inhibiting. It should help to provide intellectual order to the oftentimes chaos of a worldly experience, but it should never take the place of that experience. Artists and designers, many of whom are agile in their ability to admire and absorb complexity, visual and other, can become adept travelers and navigators of the contact zone, the place where diverse cultures intersect and are often able to transform what could be a barrier into a point of entry. Contact zone is a term introduced into linguistics by Mary Pratt to designate social spaces where disparate cultures meet, clash, and grapple with each other, often in highly asymmetrical relationships of domination and subordination, like colonialism. Where some may be resistant to difference or intimidated by the weight of history and its associated guilt and sense of responsibility, artists and designers, as professional producers of visual material and also as viewers, the audience for the visual, are often inspired by cultural originality or specificity to make their own work. Whereas social scientists feel the need to represent the entirety and complexity of societies to acknowledge cultural relativism before they are able to evaluate and respond to different societies, artists and designers, having done their own type of research and interrogation, often very focused and organized around their own interests, are adept at trusting a personalized experience of place and then acting on it. Their enthusiasm for visual and performative traditions, their intuition about what might work as a creative response in a particular context, their ability when captivated to sit still, listen, assimilate, and transform can allow them to move within other cultural settings effectively. Artists who have given these issues a great deal of thought and are willing to spend time within societies other than their own can create a free zone of hybridization, a place where multiple forms of cultural dispersion can coexist. They bring to these interactions either a consistency of media, through which they have always worked, sculpture, photography, performance, film, painting, so on, or a way of working that is historically aligned to their past projects. Through this consistency of practice, they feel confident enough to take on a project and to locate themselves in its otherness, finding something in the outside world that corresponds to a location in their interior world is no small matter. But it is remarkable that even young artists are able to do this, as I have experienced with students traveling in Southeast Asia and also in Africa. As complex as the situation of entering societies not your own may be, and as complex as the notion of cultural hybridization is, these artist-inspired creations and adaptations of traditional motifs function as transmitters of cultural integration, and these hybrid projects can be read in Luang Prabang, but also potentially in Rio, in London, Johannesburg, all locations, Chicago, New York, Boston, all locations where hybridity is understood. The work can communicate in multiple settings because it makes the connection between disparate places and disparate times through the vehicle of an artistic process and through artistic production, while acknowledging and moving beyond pastiche, appropriation, the analytic, and the ironic. Artists and designers are able to work successfully in places like Luang Prabang that are labor-intensive, in part because they so admire what local artisans, craftspeople, architects and builders make. They're interested in forms of expression, where form follows function and function follows form, and in most instances, they are very respectful of the talents of artists and artisans they encounter. In general, artists are not obsessed with the distinctions between art and popular culture or with notions of high and low art and design. While critics employ these categorizations, those who actually create the work can appreciate the subtleties and solutions presented by many types of practice, objects and actions equally, unencumbered by a need to reify them into silos of definition. In societies like Laos, where haptic production still exists, artists find inspiration from the respect accorded to the handmade, objects for everyday use, but also those intended for religious rituals. In Luang Prabang, where Buddhism plays such a prominent role, artists and designers can appreciate the abundance of iconography because they too live in a world of the metaphoric and the symbolic and are often intrigued by objects of religious significance, whether they themselves are observant or not. They understand that these objects have a crude psychic and iconic value, and that these images are often powerful as a result of this, and also because they have been fashioned by the best Lao artists. They also understand the hybrid nature of these objects, many of which have been influenced by multiple sources, including contemporary motifs and techniques from the West. Because many contemporary artists still make things by hand, those living in societies that exist within exchange-based modes of production can appreciate the pieces that artists from cultures outside their own fabricate just because they are also handmade. Even if the images are other to them, the art making is still usually rooted in one person's vision and is therefore intimate and does more than just reflect the anonymity of mass production accomplished for consumption. Rather, there is a recognizable, identifiable, imaginative source for and meaning to the project with which they can identify. And perhaps most significantly, many Western and non-Western artists are comfortable living and working in the simultaneities of time, culture, and diversities of scale that one may find in such situations. As some artists have grasped, traditional societies may be less technologically equipped to deal with 21st century modes of production, but might be better prepared to understand its present complexities, both spiritually and aesthetically, since they are used to negotiating multiple cultures, languages, and religious influences. Luang Prabang is particularly interesting since it has seen many forms of colonialism, including that of the French, the Chinese, the Americans, the Vietnamese, and has retained its Buddhist traditions in spite of the present communist regime. Where might the respect for the handmade, the made, the personal, and the collective lead creative people? It would seem to direct them to a place where many now regard, which many now regard as retro, and yet it may point to the future, a way to proceed artistically outside the gigantic morass of the market economy to something more intimate and local, but still global and significant, something of the self, but also of the world, something applicable in both a society governed by advanced capitalism and also in an exchange-based economy. There is an element of preservation in all these concerns, but preservation not just of the built environment, but also of tradition. There is an underlying fear that not only will life on the planet change considerably if we do not become more vigilant about how we produce products and conserve our resources, but that the diversity of the world's cultures and the range of their unique production will become eclipsed, universalized, and homogenized if it is not treasured. Sustainable, unsustainable practices. It makes sense that in the last decades, the world of architecture, design, and art making have helped take the lead on what is now the very fashionable concern with sustainability. Although connected to the ecology movement of the 1960s and 70s, this new iteration, which has taken form around issues of global warming, climate change, I should say, and sustainable living and design, has become the movement of this next generation of creative practitioners. As a concept, it also has thrived in the academy. This seemingly obvious and sensible idea is actually a very radical one. It goes straight to the contradictions at the heart of U.S. society and promises to have a profoundly positive effect on the future of civilization if we as humans can act on it soon enough to redeem or at least to stop the further destruction of the environment from human folly. It requires long-term thinking and planning, which in itself is quite unusual in capitalist society. It will only be achieved when people begin to think about these issues collectively. When I was dean at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, the school was closely involved with the city, with the city's project of sustainability. Chicago was one of the first to turn the roof of its city hall into a garden. Completed in 2001, it made a strong public statement about the mayor's commitment to sustainable practice. Since that time, a number of roof gardens have been created, including Millennium Park, probably the largest garden of its kind in the world. The park actually covers two enormous parking facilities. At the School of the Art Institute, we invented a curriculum called the Green Zone. It was designed to capture the undergraduate imagination as it relates to these issues and to allow students to work on projects specific to the city, their immediate environment. As part of this curriculum, students working with faculty redesigned the signage for the Chicago River, offering a practical guide while presenting the river's history in a visually engaging form. They imagined new systems for recycling and created prototypes for green roof buses, all in collaboration with city officials who were helping to determine which projects might be useful to the city while critiquing their development along the way. These projects have enabled students to see the city as a location they can impact directly, thereby pushing the notion of sustainability from the abstract to the concrete. But the implications of sustainability can go even farther into the heart of a society like that of the U.S. than these project-oriented interventions. If we take the concept of sustainability even deeper, we have to confront the most unsustainable practice in which humans engage, and that is war. Measuring the impact of war based on the concept of sustainability makes logical sense, since war is a strategy that destroys and wastes resources, human and other, in the name of speed and efficiency on an unimaginable scale that affects generations. Architects, designers, and artists as a group generally oppose war and beg for other solutions to conflict. Creative practitioners recognize in a situation like the looted museums of Iraq the destruction of an important segment of art and architectural history, never to be recovered. Once gone, these images of human consciousness and unconscious aspirations can never be reclaimed. Like the human organism itself, which artists for centuries have represented in painting and in sculpture, the loss of even one person, one body, is the loss of a unique entity, an original construction that cannot be duplicated and as such is irreplaceable. But when all else fails and pleas for peace are no longer heard, artists, designers, and architects traditionally have made serious work about what will be lost in war, what has been lost to war. Among the endless number of paintings about war and destruction, the most celebrated and known is Picasso's Guernica. Perhaps what is so significant about the effect of Picasso's images is that in the West, at least, it has come to stand for both the destruction of humanity by the irrationalities of war and the age-old longing for peace. Just a small fragment of this epic painting triggers response and can be seen on leaflets pasted on walls all over the world that use just a bit of this imagery to remind us of the horror of war and ask us to stop its seeming inevitability. Contemporary artists who see the unfortunate parallels between the Vietnam War and the war in Iraq are now restaging events of protest held during the 1960s as art pieces. We also see contemporary artists who have become obsessed with the imagery of this present-day conflict. When creative people recognize that these anti-war gestures cannot stop the destruction, some of them assume a different set of roles in the society. They are often asked to help create the icons that allow society to grieve its own catastrophes. And this is now the end, which I call fearlessness. The U.S. has been in a desperate situation, which I now feel has transformed, and we will see what the transformation will bring. And thus, more than ever, has been in need of those who are fearless. And by that I mean not afraid to say what they see. Preach the truth to the face of falsehood, wrote Herman Melville in the 19th century. We might say it again about what has happened in the last period because we heard too many lies. And deception can do to a nation what it often has done to individuals, which is cause a deep corruption of the soul. Because artists and designers are rarely given worldly power, in the U.S. at least, or tempted and therefore compromised by such possibilities, they often can live and work under the radar, as Guillermo Gomez-Pena says, of the strategies of performance artists. Because as radical and transformative as their work can be, only rarely does the society actually sense its true power. Mostly it is hidden and ironically therefore free to say what needs to be said. In art, at its freest, we recognize its true potential to show us how to love the great things of this life, to abhor their destruction, to imagine what does not as yet exist, and to refuse intimidation and encroachment of personal liberties. These are the best values that are fostered in the education offered in schools and departments of art and design. And these are the values that many young artists and designers would do well to internalize and take with them into the world, and from which they could define the purpose of their creative work and lives, which was something we talked about today. If utopia itself is a site, albeit a non-place or a not-place, an impossible place, then it is the site where such hopes originate and continue to live. Most people, it has been said, live in the past, clinging to old ideas, to the familiar. Artists, architects, and designers, we are told, have the capacity to live in the future, dreaming it into being. But perhaps we can say of this group of people that they actually live in the present, with their hyper-awareness of what exists around them intact, always aware of the pain of the past, but also able to see the opportunities, potentialities, and threats for and to the future. So perhaps artists don't live in the future, but rather in the now, aware of the simultaneities of time and the relationship between cause and effect, seen as in an instant and then captured for eternity. So I ask, can schools of art and design, with all the best intentions, channel this potentiality and make the prospect of social engagement exciting enough to compete with the versions of glamour and success presented by the art world apparatus to its constituencies? This is surely a worthy challenge. If young artists and designers want to use their skills and talents to penetrate the joys and conflicts of society in whatever forms they choose, then the work of educators will be complete. We will have successfully secured that the most creative people, all of you, the next generation, will be on a path to what I consider success, the ability to live a creative life, making work in the most elegant, poetic, imaginative ways possible, while participating in democracy as engaged and engaging citizens, committed to challenging its premises and advocating change wherever and whenever possible. Thank you.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a lecture by Carol Becker, Dean of Columbia University's School of the Arts. Tonight's lecture was presented by the Boston University College of Fine Arts as part of its Contemporary Perspectives lecture series. Dean Becker was introduced by Lynn Allen, Director of Boston University's School of Visual Arts. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Jared Mooney with help from Renee Marchando. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.